So as I said, I'm going to talk about the six distinctive features or six distinctive emphases of Triratna. So there are many, many different kinds of Buddhist, different Buddhist groups, different Buddhist communities, Buddhist orders and so on in the world. There are many different within each Buddhist country in the East, there are many different orders and different kinds of Buddhist. In Tibetan Buddhism, for instance, there are three main schools of Buddhism. And in Sri Lanka, there are different orders of Buddhists and so on. So there are many, many different Buddhist communities. And in most of these Buddhist communities have come to the West. Most of them are in Western countries, in the United States and in the UK. So there are lots of different Buddhist communities. I was looking at some statistics that even though there are not many Buddhists in the UK, or in England and Wales, apparently in the last census, there are 178,000 Buddhists, which is 0.4% of the population. By contrast, there's 1.5% of the population is Hindu and 4.8% is Muslim. So Buddhists are actually in a minority. But within that 178,000 Buddhists in England and Wales, only one third of them are converts to Buddhism. Two thirds are people who were born into Buddhist families and have come to the country and so on. So actually, that's about, 55,000, 56,000, Buddhists. So most of us here belong to that, minority of a minority, if you see what I mean. We're a tiny fraction of a fraction. And that's the same for most Buddhist groups and Buddhist communities in the UK. In Scotland, by the way, the figure is similar. There are 6,800 Buddhists in Scotland, and about one third of them are converts. In Northern Ireland, there are only 533 Buddhists. So many different Buddhists, and all broken down into all sorts of different categories. But actually, all of these groups and all of these Buddhists have quite a lot in common, even though we're broken up into lots of different groups and communities and so on. There's practices we have in common. Meditation is pretty much common to all Buddhists. Ethics, study of the scripture, study of either Pali Canon Suttas or sutras and so on, rituals, chanting. There are lots of things that we have in common among Buddhists. There's symbols like the Buddha image. The Buddha image is common to most Buddhists. A lot of Buddhists will have Dharma Chakra, possibly mandalas of some kind, and wheel of life, and so on. So lots of different symbols in common as well. There are probably other things they have in common which I can't think of off the top of my head with other Buddhists. But what I wanted to talk about this evening is not what we have in common, but what's distinctive. So Each Buddhist community and Buddhist group has a distinctive flavor or maybe a distinctive emphasis. So some groups will emphasize meditation. Actually, quite a lot of Buddhist groups emphasize meditation. So meditation is not that distinctive. It's a strong feature of lots of groups. Some may emphasize chanting a particular mantra, something like the Amitabha mantra. Some will emphasize much more study, for instance. So there'll be an emphasis on different things in different groups. So Sangharaksha has talked about the six things that distinguish the Triratna Buddhist community, the six distinctive features, or he also refers to them often as the six distinctive emphases, so the things that we emphasize, which means that they may not be completely distinctive. Other groups might have similar things, but we emphasize these things. They're emphasized in our tradition. Uh, Of course, we also share values with other Buddhists, like loving kindness and mindfulness and wisdom and compassion and so on, non-violence. So the distinctive features of Triratna, the first one, he talks about it as that we're an ecumenical Buddhist group. Now, ecumenical is a word that's taken from the Christian context. It's specifically about aspects within the Christian tradition, people who see the unity between Christian churches. Yeah, so it's about unity. And so what Sangharakshita is getting at is that in the Triratna community, we look to the unity of Buddhism. What unites Buddhists? What the factors of the Dharma that are unifying. So this is different from eclectic. Sometimes we're thought of or mistaken for an eclectic Buddhist group. But eclectic is something a bit different. It's more to do with picking and choosing, as it were. So an eclectic, if we were an eclectic Buddhist group, we'd be picking and choosing from, as it were, what we like or what we prefer or whatever. A bit like wandering through the supermarket of Buddhism, picking things off the shelf. But that's not what we are. What we are is ecumenical, which is that the teachings and practices and so on within Triratna are based on a vision or a sense or a sympathy with the unifying factors in Buddhism. What unites Buddhists? Yeah? What unites Buddhist traditions? And Sangharakshita talks about the approach being a critical appreciation of Buddhism. So it's appreciative of Buddhist teachings, but critical in the sense it doesn't take everything at face value. So for instance, there will be much in some Buddhist traditions which is as much cultural as Buddhist, or maybe more cultural than Buddhist. So we don't necessarily have to take that on board, since we're not Sri Lankan or Tibetan or Burmese or whatever. Yes, so a critical appreciation of the Buddhist tradition. And if any of you have come across Bhante's book, The Survey of Buddhism, in there he really is focusing on this unity in Buddhism. So he talks about the whole of Buddhism, basing it around the five spiritual faculties. So he's seeing the unity. So in Triratna we study the Pali Canon from early Buddhism, from southern Buddhism as it were, but we also take teachings from the Mahayana, and we take teachings from things like the Songs of Milarepa and the Life and Liberation of Padmasambhava, which are more like the Tantric or Vajrayana tradition, and also from Zen and so on. Yeah, this is the ecumenical emphasis of Triratna, and this is what our first talk is going to be on next week. Vajrakhetu, who's sitting over there, is going to be talking about the unity of Buddhism. I'm not sure what approach he's going to take, but I'm sure it'll be interesting. The second distinctive emphasis in Triratna that Bhante talks about is that we're a unified movement, a unified Buddhist community. And he means this in two senses. One, we're unified in the sense that we're open to everyone. We're open to all people, regardless of nationality, race. I've written the whole list down here. It doesn't matter nationality, race, color, education, class or caste, cultural background, gender, sexual orientation, or age. It's open to everyone, no matter what age you are, what gender you are, what your sexual orientation and so on, what nationality. It's open to everyone. So it's unified in that sense. There's no distinction. And also in a more specific sense, in that it's the same ordination for men and women in the Triratna Buddhist order. This is quite revolutionary within Buddhism in a way. And also the fact that within Triratna, women ordain women as well. In traditional Buddhism, women are often subservient to the men, to the monks and whatever, and have to follow more rules and so on. So Yes, so this is the second distinctive feature, a distinctive emphasis of Triratna. And this is what Subhadramati will be talking about in the second talk. She'll be going into this whole area of the, well, the unity of our movement, the unity of Triratna. And I'm sure she'll talk particularly about the ordination because, well, she's a private preceptor. She ordains people and I'm sure she'll have something to say about that. The third distinctive emphasis or distinctive feature of Triratna, which is actually the most important one, is the key one, is the centrality of the act of going for refuge to the Buddha, Dharma and Sangha. So going for refuge to the Buddha, Dharma and Sangha, putting the Buddha, Dharma and Sangha at the center of your life, making a commitment to the Buddha and Dharma and Sangha, making a commitment to the Buddha as the ideal of enlightenment, to the Dharma as the path of practice, and to the Sangha as those who have gone before us, who've got more experience and so on. But also to the Sangha in the sense of those that we are practicing with in terms of helping each other. Yes, so in the Dhammapada, it talks about false refuges, you could say. It says, many people out of fear flee for refuge to sacred hills, woods, groves, trees and shrines. In reality, this is not a safe refuge. In reality, this is not the best refuge. Fleeing to such a refuge, one is not released from all suffering. And then it talks about the true refuge of the three jewels. But of course, for us, these false refuges are no longer what we have as false. We don't flee for refuge to hills and groves and woods and trees and shrines. We flee for refuge to shopping centres and you know where. The internet and goodness knows where else. Maybe we've all got our favourite equivalent of trees and shrines and woods and groves. So partly what we're talking about here is putting something at the centre of our lives, or having something that's meaningful at the centre of our lives, which is which we, as it were, organise our lives around, which affects everything else in our lives. So that is what the going for refuge is about. So what Buddhism is saying is that the Buddha, the ideal of enlightenment or the ideal of wisdom and compassion and the Dharma, the path to transformation and the Sangha, that these are something that will... that they're reliable, basically. They will give meaning and purpose to your life, and they will they'll come up with the goods, as it were. You will become happy. You will overcome suffering. Bhante has talked about going for refuge a lot, and in lots of different ways. There are a number of writings about going for refuge, which are well worth looking into. He's done at least two or three talks on going for refuge, looking at it from different angles. And some of them are published in different books. I know one is in the Guide to the Buddhist Path. I'm not sure where the others are. Oh, one is in the Meaning of Conversion in Buddhism. That's a very good one. And he talks about levels of going for refuge. So he talks about ethnic going for refuge, provisional going for refuge, effective going for refuge, and real going for refuge. So giving a sense of that there's a deepening commitment or a deepening understanding of what one is doing with one's life when one is practicing the Dharma. So going from it being something not fully understood to something that's actually more than fully understood. It's actually fully lived or fully embodied. Yeah. He also talks about dimensions of going for refuge, like an altruistic dimension or an insight dimension and so on. So this this will be talked about by Arya Jaya. She's going to talk about the going for refuge as a distinctive feature of Tri Ratna. But not only that, this is the most important one. So we're going to have 4 weeks with Vasantra, who will be going into the different dimensions and aspects of going for refuge. So we're going to explore going for refuge very thoroughly in February and March as we go through this whole series of talks. Then the fourth distinctive emphasis is spiritual friendship. So friendship is a basic human need. Arta City was talking this morning about some program he'd seen on BBC iPlayer called The Age of Loneliness, and it's about just how prevalent loneliness is in our society. And it's not necessarily just elderly people or something like that. It's people at all levels of society and all walks of life who experience loneliness. Loneliness is quite common. It's quite a heartbreaking thing to experience if you ever experience loneliness. I don't know how many of you have experienced loneliness, but when you do experience it, it's a very difficult state to find yourself in. And you can find yourself being lonely in the midst of crowds, maybe especially in the midst of crowds, you can find yourself being lonely. I remember experiencing loneliness quite acutely one time in London, in the midst of millions of people, but acute loneliness. So friendship is, as it were, not just the antidote to this, but it fulfills that basic human need. But spiritual friendship is a practice in itself. It goes beyond just fulfilling that basic need for not to be isolated. And spiritual friendship, the main point about it is that it's based on shared spiritual values. Arta City was mentioning this as he was talking to us this morning about this program. He was saying that when he was younger, because he had spiritual values, even though he had friends, he felt lonely because they didn't share his values. So sometimes actually having spiritual values can be a lonely place in within groups of people who don't actually share those values. You can feel you can't, something you can't talk about, something you can't share, whatever. So spiritual friendship is based on having those common values, common going for refuge, you could say, to the Buddha and Dharma Sangha, common commitment, common practices, and so on. And of course, the Buddha recommended spiritual friendship. He recommended, particularly in the Migya Sutta, he recommends it to Migya, who is a young man who is very impatient and wants to, make progress, gain insight, whatever, immediately. And the Buddha tells him that the first thing he needs is spiritual friends, and that everything else will be based on that, will emerge from that. He also, of course, famously spoke to Ananda about spiritual friendship being the whole of the spiritual life, which is quite a something to get your head around what that means. It's obviously to do with the fact that our sense of self, our sense of separate self, is a delusion, as it were. So spiritual friendship is completely opposed to or undermines that. In our tradition in Tri Ratna, we talk about spiritual friendship in terms of vertical friendship and horizontal friendship. Horizontal friendship meaning friendship with those who are on a similar level or a similar stage of the path. So we can be mutually helpful. We can have people to talk about how we're getting on in our meditation, or how we're getting on with ethics, or how difficult we find Buddhism, or how difficult we find being on retreat, or whatever. All these things that people come up against. But actually sharing with other people who are practicing means that we gradually see quite clearly that actually what we are thinking of as our problem, perhaps, is shared. It's just a natural human thing. For instance, that when you start to meditate, when you start to become more aware and start to integrate, that actually you notice how unaware you are. It's one of the first things you notice, is that you're not aware. But it's not that you're particularly unaware, it's just that that's what happens, and it happens to everybody, more or less. There might be some lucky souls who don't experience that. Yeah. So, yes, so we talk about horizontal friendship, and we talk about vertical friendship in the sense of friendship with people you can learn from. Well, both ways, people you can teach or give something to, or people you can learn from, people who are more experienced than you, and so on. So, and that, of course, is very important, because if others have gone ahead, as it were, they can point out the pitfalls to you and also maybe throw a little bit of light on some of the things that puzzle you. So spiritual friendship is a practice, basically. It's something that we do. And it's something that we do quite consciously and deliberately, which is different from ordinary friendship, which is usually something that you maybe fall into because of shared interest or something like that. You know, like you both share an interest in darts or gardening or embroidery or whatever it is. You know, that can be a basis for a friendship. But spiritual friendship is something that we take as a practice. We practice, it's basically the practice of communication, of which, of course, listening is a huge component. So it's practice of becoming aware of another person, or two people, as it were, becoming mutually aware, listening to each other, understanding each other, sharing their lives, yeah. Again, there's lots of writings within Sri Ratna about spiritual friendship. Bhante has written about it. In the Guide to the Buddhist Path, there's some very good chapters in there, which based on lectures that he's given. And then Maitreya Bandhu has written a book about spiritual friendship called Thicker Than Blood. Yeah. And Subhuti has written a book about spiritual friendship, title of which I cannot remember. And there are some very good talks. There's one by Dhammadina and some by Padmavajra, which are very, very good talks. I think the one by Dhammadina is particularly addressed to women, but it's a very good talk as well for any. And spiritual friendship, Artha Siddhi is going to talk to us about spiritual friendship later probably at the end of March. Artha Siddhi, of course, is the Mitra convener for men, so he's befriending lots of people. So that's the fourth distinctive feature, or distinctive emphasis of Sri Ratna. The fifth one is team-based right livelihood. So this was an attempt to aid the development of a more ethical economy, in a way, an ethical economic order, I think is what Bhante calls it. And also, of course, to be a source of funding for Dharma projects. This is an area that has declined quite a lot within Sri Ratna in the last 10 years or so. When I was looking at a talk that Bhante gave in 1999, and at that time there were, 31 team-based right livelihood businesses in the UK. At present there are probably about half a dozen, so it's been quite a big decline in the last 10 years or so. That perhaps means it's time for that to be revived. Time has come for a revival, perhaps. The main characteristics of team-based right livelihood were to to provide support for people working in it, obviously, to lead a simple life. Also to have a livelihood that was ethical, in the sense that the activity that you were doing, whatever it was an ethical activity. Also to provide an opportunity for people to develop spiritual friendship, because if you're working alongside people, you're much more likely to do that. I've worked in Team Best Right Livelihood. I've lived in Buddhist communities and so on. And actually working with people is by far the most difficult thing to do, and also the most rewarding, because you really have to communicate with people, and you really have to rely on people when you work with them in a way that you don't have to if you just live with people or just meet them for coffee or whatever. Yeah. And the fourth characteristic of Right Team Best Right Livelihood was that it was trying to generate surplus profits to give to Dharma activities or Dharma projects. Yes, I think it's a great shame that we don't have team-based right livelihoods. It is a way of Buddhism engaging with the world in a way that even a Buddhist center doesn't engage with the world. So you could say running a Buddhist center, which is what myself and others of us here do, is a right livelihood, as it were. It's definitely ethical and so on. But actually being involved in business out in the world and trying to run that business as a Buddhist enterprise is really engaging with the world and bringing your values into the world in a very direct way. So I do hope in future that Team Best Right Livelihood does revive in our movement. We're having Shraddha Geeta, who's an order member from London, coming to speak to us about Team Best Right Livelihood. She has worked in Team Best Right Livelihoods for many, many years, and she is still working in a Team Best Right Livelihood in London. They have a charity shop which sells second-hand goods and so on, and they're very successful. They last year they gave £50,000 to the London Buddhist Centre, so they're a very successful Team Best Right Livelihood business. So it'll be very interesting to hear what she has to say about both her experience of working in Team Best Right Livelihood and maybe the wider challenge of it. There is a book, a Triratna book by Padmasuri, which is about Team Best Right Livelihood. I'm losing track of titles, though. I have no idea what it's called. Can anyone remember?
Transforming Work.
Okay, that's the title. Yeah. So I don't know if it's still in print, but it's probably in our library if anyone's interested. Then the sixth distinctive feature of Triratna is the arts, the emphasis on the arts. So Bhante has talked about engaging with the arts, and he's talked about it as providing a way to refine the emotions, yeah? A way to refine and direct the emotions. He's talked about it as a way of broadening our sympathies and extending our experience, engaging with the arts. And also, he talks about it as communicating spiritual values. So art, at its best, communicates spiritual values. So in terms of the Buddhist community, there will be artists who are trying to communicate Buddhist values through their art, and also those of us who are not artists trying to engage with art in a way that allows us to be affected by it. It's very much part of Bhante's emphasis on the importance of the imagination as well. He's very strongly emphasized the importance of the imagination, the importance of the imagination to spiritual practice, the importance of the imagination to gaining insight into the nature of reality. The imagination rather than the intellect rather than thought or rational thought and so on. And he's written quite a lot about art. I mean, his most important book is probably The Religion of Art, where he lays out his whole, as it were, theory of art. There's also an interview with him, which has been published as a book called In the Realm of the Lotus. It was an interview with a Finnish film director, I think it was. And they made a film which was shown on Finnish television sometime in the 1990s. I've never seen it, but Finnish TV has seen it. He's also written about the imagination in a couple of talks or booklets, The Journey to Il Convento and Saint Jerome Revisited. He talks about how he's responded to images of Saint Jerome that you see in many, particularly in Renaissance paintings, you see these images of Saint Jerome, and he talks about his response to that. Yes, in many places where he talks about his responses to the arts. I must say that personally, before I got involved with Sri Ratna, I had no relationship with the arts whatsoever. I don't think I'd ever been to an art gallery, and I wasn't interested in music particularly. Poetry and literature I was interested in, but the other arts not at all. And being in Sri Ratna has been a real education for me in the arts. And not only that, but actually I've some of my strongest spiritual experiences have been in contexts of the arts, particularly with paintings, which I would never have believed before. Partly because I didn't know anything about paintings and I'd never engaged with them. But having done so, they've proved invaluable, I would say, as a bridge between Western culture and Buddhism for me. Yeah. And Tara Dasa is going to talk to us about the arts later in the season. And we may have another talk about the arts, but I'm not sure yet. There's somebody else who said they may want to give a talk on the arts. So those are the six distinctive features, the six distinctive emphases of Sri Ratna. So Sri Ratna is ecumenical in the sense that it looks to the unity of Buddhism and takes from the whole Buddhist tradition what helps us on the spiritual path. Not in a pick and mix kind of way, but in a sense of what actually helps. Then there's the emphasis on the unity of the whole movement, the unity of the order and so on, same ordination for men and women. Everybody, the spiritual community is open to everybody. And then there's the emphasis on going for refuge, the centrality of going for refuge, the centrality of commitment to the Buddha and Dharma and Sangha. That's what spiritual life is about. That's what we're saying. And that is the most important of our distinctive features. You have going for refuge within lots of Buddhist traditions, but often it's simply a matter of reciting the refuges and precepts. But Bhante Sangharakshita has taken it and said, this is what makes you a Buddhist. This is the main practice. This is everything else has to fall into place around this. Then fourthly, there's spiritual friendship, which is again key to our practice. We don't rely just on meditation. We don't rely just on study. We bring in this element of communication and emotional engagement with each other as well. The Dharma is not it's not an abstraction. It's not an impersonal thing. It's about being a human being in a world of living beings, not just other human beings, a world of living beings. So spiritual friendship is the pinnacle, as it were, of being a human being among other human beings. And then there's the emphasis on, which one have I got to remember? The emphasis on team-based right livelihood, bringing our Buddhist practices into the sphere of economics, into the sphere of money, and so on, and not being concerned about accumulation, but living a simple life and giving. So it's a practice of generosity, as well as ethics. And then the sixthly, the emphasis on the arts as a ancillary to the path, as it were, as a way of something else that can help us along the spiritual path. So the since these are what differentiates our Buddhist tradition here, the Sri Ratna Buddhist community from other Buddhist traditions, it's important that we understand them, that we know what they are and that we understand them. And that's why we're going to have this series of six talks that we'll explore in detail each one of these emphases. I think that's probably all I'm going to say. Yes, and do remember that Vasantra will come and explore the centrality of going for refuge with us in even more detail. So that's important. So yes, do come along to the talks. Come along and we'll be learning and practicing at the same time, which can't be bad. Yeah. Okay, so we're going to have a tea break now, and after a tea break we'll come back and do a short puja with the green Tara mantra, and it'll be dedicated to Chetal Sangha Dorje, and I will, as I said, read out something that Sangharakshita has written about Chetal Sangha Dorje, who, being one of Bhante's teachers, is also part of our lineage, as it were. He's considered to be one of the three great Tibetan teachers of the 20th century. Okay, that's all. Thank you.